Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
I bet you're smart.
Yeah, and you like to hold your own in the group chat.
We can help you drop even more knowledge. My name is Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Izadi. We host a daily news podcast called Post Reports.
Every weekday afternoon, Post Reports takes you inside an important and interesting story with the kind of reporting that you can only get from The Washington Post.
You can listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. Go find it now and hit follow.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to Soft Web Radio. Soft Web Radio, on time, on target. We have a very special guest rejoining us again, General Don Bolduc. If those of you who can recall, he joined us about a year or so ago. He was the commander of SOC Africa. He was one of the initial troops in our war in Afghanistan back in 2001. Man, it seems like yesterday. It was almost 20 years ago. And now he's running for Senate in my former state of New Hampshire, so a state that's near and dear to my heart. So we want to welcome General Bolduc back to the podcast. Sir, thank you for taking the time to join us this afternoon. We really appreciate it.
Steve, thank you very much, and it's great to be here once again, and my very best to your listeners.
Well, thank you for taking the time today. You know, I was looking at your website, and I saw that one of your endorsers was my favorite Red Sox player growing up, Rico Petrocelli. I was like, I was more excited to see that than anything else.
I tell you what, I have become very good friends with Rico Petrocelli, and what an honor it was. You know, he discovered I was running, listening to The War Room, Steve Bannon's program, and I've been appearing on Steve Bannon's program periodically because I was one of I guess now a little over 300, but it was originally 124 of us that signed a letter with, you know, 12 points of concern about the direction of our country, you know, everything from election integrity to, teaching CRT in our military, right? I call it critical race training, right? Because that's simply what it is. But nonetheless, just being on his show, Rico said, hey, he's running for Senate in my home state. I got to talk to this guy. So he reached out to somebody who connected us, and we went to lunch, and we have been, he's been supporting me ever since. He sits on my strategy team, and I just, what a great guy, what a down-to-earth guy, you know, a father of four, 9 grandchildren, been living in Nashua, New Hampshire for 22 years, just a great charitable man, does a lot of fundraising for a variety of different great causes. So I'm glad you saw his name. He's a good man.
Yeah. You know, when I first started watching baseball right around the 1967 season, when I was a youngster, Rico was part of that impossible dream team, which those of us who grew up in Boston, in the area, you know, New England area, that was my favorite Red Sox team of all time. And he was a big part of that. And of course, being of Italian descent. So, you know, Rico was obviously one of my favorite players. And when I saw that, I was like genuinely excited. I didn't know if he was still living in the area. So that's really
neat. Yeah, he's great. You know, he signed with Boston in 63. He got on the team permanently in 65, played to 76. I grew up with him being a Red Sox, you know, player along with Yaz and you know, Fisk and all the greats. And it was just awesome to meet somebody that we would, pick up games in the sandlot there. We all had a Red Sox player name, right? Depending on what position you played. So it was pretty cool.
Yes, sir. Well, getting back to, I know there's a military podcast, not a baseball one, so we'll get back on track here. But I just wanted to throw that in before I forgot. But I know, you know, with the war winding down in Afghanistan, you know, last reports were about 95% withdrawn from that. I know that you spoke in favor of President Trump's plan to withdraw from there. Has anything changed for you? I know recently there's been a lot of stuff about the Taliban executing people, prisoners and stuff like that. Has any of this changed for you?
Well, I got to tell you, yes, I was. So the short answer is yes, things have changed. And I was an advocate for getting out of Afghanistan when President Trump suggested it as a candidate and then as president. And in my mind, he gave the Secretary of Defense, then Jim Mattis, and the Secretary of State and the National Security Council staff and CENTCOM and ISAF and many others the warning order. Hey, I want to get out of Afghanistan. You know, and 2 years into his first term, he called for the plan and they didn't have one. And I think that was, to me, they let him down and they let America down. And the reason why I wanted out was in 2014, they changed strategy, which reversed all the security gains we had in the rural area. The Taliban resurged, Al-Qaeda resurged, and then ISIS saw an opportunity to come in. And we simply just did not have a policy and a strategy that supported body bags and hospital beds. And once again, our general officers and our senior military folks let us down. And I'm one of those general officers that let you down. I could not convince anybody that changing strategy was going to be detrimental to the mission. And remember, when we started this new strategy in 2010 under General McChrystal and then really solidified it under General Petraeus and then pushed it over the goal line on the way to victory under General Allen, we had the highest casualty rates in Afghanistan in 2010. We were behind in the insurgency. The Taliban was resurging. They owned most of the rural area. And in 3.5 years, we reversed that with village stability operations, the Afghan local police. And our our casualty rates came down, all-time low, and we owned almost 90% of the rural areas by the middle of 2013, and we just needed a couple more years to solidify it. The Taliban was saying, if they keep doing this, we're not going to win. So we even had a vote from the enemy, right? And although the Taliban could beat the Afghan military and the Afghan police in a fight, they couldn't beat the Afghan local police. The local police are the Arbakai type fighters that special ops went in and, you know, trained our small teams, training them. And they took over the security situation. They developed the will to fight. They developed the plan, and it was working fabulously. Nothing's perfect. There's always going to be problems with it. But suffice it to say, the strategy was on track. The operational approach was on track. The tactics matched the, you know, the goals of the strategy. And then I'm sitting in a meeting with the new commander, Dunford, and the new chief of staff of Obama's White House, and General Milley and General Thomas and the rest of them. And they lay out this plan to discontinue combat operations, come out of the villages. And I'm like, well, respectfully, time out. That's not a good idea right now. It's a good idea a couple of years from now, but it's not a good idea right now. And I laid it out, and I even gave him a RAND study that proved it, right? I made him mad. They sent me to Africa, and you know, that was the end of that. But I continued to write about it. I continued to write about my strong objections to the change in strategy. And what happened? We changed the strategy, security situation reversed. Taliban resurged, Al-Qaeda resurged, ISIS came into the fight, and our casualty rates were at an all-time high by 2019. And so if we didn't have a good strategy executing the war, how the hell does anyone think we're going to have a good strategy coming out of the war? And that's what I disagree with. That's what's changed that I don't like. We should have had a better strategy, because this isn't good. And, you know, General Miller, you know, I like General Miller. General Miller is respected, but General Miller was part of the problem. As a two-star and a three-star, he could have intervened and he could have said, hey, listen, we had a good strategy here. He knows it was a good strategy because he was my general officer that I worked for when we put the strategy in place. And in 2011, I got him walking around in all these areas that we took back from the Taliban with no kit on, no kit. Not even a hat. All he had was a sidearm, walking through the markets, walking through all these areas that now he needs to be full kitted up with a complement of, you know, a platoon of guys, you know, securing him. So he knows that there was a bad decision. And like all of them, they did nothing to stand up and say, excuse me, sir, this is a bad strategy. This is a bad decision at this time. We understand what your goal is, and we're with you on that. However, we can't do that. And then not to leave the counterterrorism task force in the region to be able to deal with that, and to just, you know, bug out. China's going to take advantage of it. Russia's going to take advantage of it. Iran's going to come in full force. North Korea's going to follow China. The region is going to go to hell in a handbag, most likely. And that's a dangerous region with Pakistan and India with nuclear weapons, the Stan brothers up north, Iran out to the west. It's just bad policy. It's bad decisions by general officers who are political in nature, more interested in their career and their next job than they are in making sure that we have a good strategy, we give best military advice. And if that means you lose your job, well, that means you lose your job, but at least you stand on principle.
Very good. I wanted to ask you about the early days in 2001, when the troops first went in. Back then, I believe you were either captain or a major at that time.
Yeah, just
what were those first few months like, when it was strictly just like an SF CIA type operation there?
It was awesome. And it was the way that we needed to fight. We had small teams in there on the ground. We didn't take away the Afghans' will to fight. We didn't take over the fight. We augmented them with air support. We augmented them with getting them the equipment that they needed, the weapons that they needed in order to fight. and take the fight to the enemy. And you know, it was a quintessential special forces mission, right? I mean, unconventional in nature, asymmetric in its tactics, you know, small teams achieving strategic results. And I believe that by June of 2002, we could have left. And we could have left the Afghans to handle it. We could have given them economic support. And we wouldn't be in this mess that we're in today. That was you know, decision point number one that we should have made, but we didn't. We decided to stay, and we decided to half step it. And then we decided to create a constitution and write it in, you know, in Western lingo, which they didn't like. We named their country, which they didn't like. We brought in contractors. We put contracts in, which created corruption. And then we said, hey, we're going to tell you what kind of justice system you're going to have, which didn't work. We tried to take religion out of their governance, which doesn't work in a Muslim country. What else we do? Oh, yeah. We tried to create military and police in the image of Western forces, which doesn't work. Afghanistan never protected itself and never won its wars with a top-down military structure or top-down police structure. It always did it from within the villages. And we completely lost our minds, and then we half-stepped it. And when Iraq kicked off on 19 March 2003, the sucking sound from Afghanistan could be heard around the world. I mean, that was the sound that was heard around the world, and we just didn't get anything to be able to fight and you know, do anything with the insurgency. So guess what? From 2003 to 2005, poof. And then from 2005 to 2010, it got stronger and stronger. And then we decide we're going to hand over peacekeeping missions to NATO, and they were completely taken by surprise, despite the efforts of special ops to say, hey, there's an insurgency here, and if you don't come in here ready to fight an insurgency, it's going to get ugly for you. And it did get ugly for them. And that resulted in you know, Medusa, you know, the battle, Medusa in 2005 and six, and then Bazooka in 2006 to seven. And it wasn't until General McChrystal came in with a different idea, different approach, bottom up instead of top down, and asked us to write a supporting plan, which we listened to the Afghans and we looked at history. We listened to what the Russians had to say. We listened to what everybody had to say. And we put together this program, and it was something that the Afghans recognized. It was 1/8 the cost of the military and the police. And it just took off. Because why? It's how they defended themselves against Alexander the Great, Genghis Khan, the Brits, the Russians. So it's proven to work. And we abandoned it. So, you know, 20 years of
you missed those early strategy, days,
except for the first rotation, and then, you know, 2010 to 2013 and a half. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, terrible. And no one's going to be held accountable for it. But the point that needs to be made is our men and women, our service members, they did a hell of a job. Every crazy thing that they were asked to do, they did well. Even when they knew it wasn't the right thing to do, they still did it. They went out there. They served with honor. And that's the thing you don't hear right now is our troops did a superb job, right? Of course, you're not going to get the Joint Chiefs or anybody that came before them or the senior military leaders to include General Austin when he was a CENTCOM commander say, hey, we failed them. They're not going to say, I'm going to say that, and I'm going to say I failed them, and I'm going to include myself in that because I'm not one that points fingers. Yes, I was a general officer during this time frame. Yes, I did 10 tours in Afghanistan. Yes, I know a lot about Afghanistan, but the more you know about Afghanistan, the less you know about Afghanistan. And you got to remain humble. There's a right way to do things and there's a wrong way to do things. And we had to listen to our people, and we didn't listen to our people. And yeah, there's a lot of, you know, that's a lot of regrets there. 72 service members I lost in 10 tours. And I think about them every single day. And we let them down because of bad strategy and bad policy, both during and now coming out of there. It's upsetting.
Sir, you were one of the very few, if not the only, general officer that was open about his own struggles with PTSD. How's that working out for you? And I saw a picture of your dog, Victor. Is he a big help to you?
Victor's a great help to me. Yeah, he's sitting right behind me right here. And more importantly, he's a great help to many, many others as well. No matter where I go with Victor, Victor changes the mood and attitude of every room, every place we go to. And so let me get back to the beginning of your question. Yeah. So my wife noticed, hey, this guy's, you know, he's not the same guy, you know, and he acts differently, and he's, you know, not comfortable at home, and he's hypervigilant all the time, and he's moody all the time, and he's, you know, his balance is off, and, you know, just a whole bunch of things. And she started noticing it in 2008, and she was encouraging me to go for help, but hey, there was no help going to be given out in 2008, and it's questionable even today. I'd like to make some comments about Owen Ray when I get a chance here, but after this. Bottom line is, it wasn't until 2013 when she drew the line and said, hey, listen, you got to go get some help. So I was in AFRICOM. I had just been promoted to one star. I went to Longstuhl. I met a wonderful nurse named Sarah McNary, and she's known all over the SOF community for all the great work she's done for us. She helped me put together the program in SOC Africa after I came to grips with my own issues, my own problems. And listen, I finally realized, hey, as a leader, right, particularly a general officer, if you can't take care of yourself, you got no business taking care of anybody else or being in charge of anybody else. And let's face it, we have mental injuries, physical injuries, and spiritual injuries. And if you're going to keep sending people off to war, rotation after rotation after rotation, you've got to address those things. And we know that. We know it. We should be better. But we weren't. And after about 2 years, from 2013 to 2015, I was doing it under the radar because I was a coward, right? I was afraid of what impact it would have on my career. And let's face it, you know, as a general officer, I had some latitude to go to doctor's appointments and Longstuhl that the men and women working for me just didn't have. And I thought, this is unfair. And when I became the SOC Africa commander on April 24th, 2015, I said to myself, this has got to change. And I talked to my senior enlisted advisor, Rich Buglisi, a Navy SEAL master chief. And I talked to my deputy commander, and I talked to my subordinate commanders, and we all agreed we got to do something. And so we did it. And we worked with Sarah McNary, and we put together a great program for the men and women. And I came out and I said, I get therapy for post-traumatic stress. I get therapy for traumatic brain injury. I get therapy for sleep disorder and pain management issues and so on and so forth. And I believe that you guys need the opportunity to do that. And we've created a system to do it. And I will support you. You won't be taken out of your job. You won't lose your clearance. I will provide top cover for you. And I did it, even if it was inconsistent with DOD policy, because DOD policy was wrong. And I was willing to say it was wrong. And nobody was going to tell me to change because they knew it was wrong as well, even though they told me, this is not going to bode well for your career. And I said, well, I'm not doing it for my career. I'm doing it for the men and women in my command because we're hurting. And I tell you what, Steve, after 26 months of doing this program, we identified 52 people with post-traumatic stress, 471 with traumatic brain injury, numerous people with pain management issues, sleep disorders, self-medication issues, so on and so forth. Our alcohol and drug incidents, whew, almost down to zero.
Almost. That's amazing.
Inside the unit, sexual harassment, inappropriate behavior in the work area, whew, down to nothing. Right? I mean, zero, goose eggs, nothing, right? Domestic issues, family issues, right? Whew, down. Every measurable area that we were looking at as leaders and passing it off as indiscipline was a direct result of mental injuries and people not having the ability to properly deal with how their brain has changed because we've thrown them in combat rotation after rotation after rotation after rotation, right? Unbelievable. And I offered this program to Special Operations Command. General Thomas didn't want anything to do with it, really. And nobody else wanted anything to do it. And I thought it would be a great program for the rest of the Special Operations Commands, the rest of the SOC. No. First thing the commander did that replaced me was get rid of the program. And so we're hurting our people, and we know we're hurting our people. And we hurt Colonel Ray, Owen Ray. Everything that happened to him was avoidable. There was an IG complaint against him. And I'm telling you, I met people that didn't have a lot of good things to say about him. You know, family members and subordinates, because he was suffering personally and professionally. And he was self-medicating. And the sad thing about it is he's a good leader and a well-respected leader, but he wasn't being able to optimize any of that because he didn't get any therapy and any help with these issues of post-traumatic stress and other issues that he had. And that's what the IG investigation told the chain of command. And what did the chain of command do? They ignored it. And then what happened to him? Got worse and worse and worse until it culminated into an event involving a gun with his family and their home and the police. And now he's facing criminal charges. And the chain of command back then didn't do anything. It's the same chain of command, except they all got promoted, right? And now they're not helping him, right? And this is a bad thing. And I'm going to write another article for Soft Rep, you know, putting this out. Lieutenant General Dietrich, Lieutenant General Baudet. You know, these guys need to be held accountable for their lack of action, right? The same things that they did during the Niger ambush, right? Not taking care of our guys there, pointing the fingers, right? Trying to protect their, their boys, trying to protect the higher chain of command. This is just wrong. We got to stop doing this. We have to stop doing it. We have a series of senior leaders that are part of the good old boys club, organizational nepotism. They take care of each other at the expense of the people that they're supposed to be helping. And someone's got to do something about it. And if someone's got to do something about it, quick.
Well, that brings us to, why you're running for office, because, I read something you wrote, I want to say it was about 2 or 3 years ago for Small Wars Journal, about there being a leadership lack, I guess would be the great word way to describe it, in our national government and in the top echelons of our military.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I did write an article about it. I experienced it, right? Listen,
right.
I have my own faults, right? I mean, I'm not a perfect leader either. I had to learn how to be a good leader. I had to learn how to do things. I had to admit things. I had to look at myself in the mirror and say, hey, listen, this is not good. It's one of the reasons I went for treatment for PTS and TBI. I had guys that worked for me when I was a battalion commander and I was an 06 who came to work for me in SOC Africa and said, wow, you are the same guy. You're motivated, purpose, direction, all that. But your approach is much different. Yes, I'm a better version of myself, right? Because I got treatment, and that's what's lacking. And people are afraid to say, I'm still the only general officer in SOF to publish an article calling himself out in the New York Times saying, hey, listen, I wasn't an optimal leader, and I had tremendous responsibilities. And we need everyone else to do that as well. You shouldn't not be promoted because of that. You get help and you move forward, right? And that's where we're stuck. We pick people in our own image. We exclude those that that are contrarians. We don't like contrarians, Steve. If somebody disagrees with you, they're out of the club. Oh, they can't disagree with me. How dare they disagree with me, right? And that's not right either. Right now, we have a generals and admirals who are totally political, and you prove it. I've watched them change from late Bush era through the Obama era into the Trump era and now into the Biden era. They change their stripes. They change, they're chameleons. They're political in nature. They're allowing critical race training to occur in our military. They're creating problems where they're not at. They're not focusing on war fighting. Our military is not ready to fight. It needs to be ready to fight. And they have nobody to blame but themselves. Oh, you know what they do? They say, oh, it must be the battalion commander's fault. So we're going to put a bunch more programs in for battalion commanders and lieutenant colonels. And we're going to look how we select lieutenant colonels and majors and captains and blah, 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 blah. When we should be looking at how we select senior leaders. And the Senate needs to stop rubber stamping these lists that come over. And they need to do their job and take a deep look in that. However, problem with that is, you know, they genuflect when a general walks into the Senate chamber. They're looking for a ring to kiss, and they don't hold them accountable. And a lot of them are inexperienced, and they don't even know how to ask them the right questions, right? Well, I want to be a United States senator, be able to do that. The DOD needs reform, and the only way it's going to get reform is from the outside in. We have to be better than we are, because right now we have not earned the privilege to command the men and women that we command.
Well, you already answered my next question, because that was going to be, why in the world would you want to run for office in Congress after already serving 33 years in active duty? And you just answered that. But
well, Steve, I've been asked by people in New Hampshire in all 10 counties. I've received correspondence from people in all 50 states and all over the military to run for the United States Senate. That's my why. If one person thinks that I can make a difference for them and serve them and move these career politicians out of the way and create a less divisive political environment so that we can get stuff done in this country, then I'm going to try it.
Yeah, that's the biggest problem we have right now. You know, I can remember in the old days, I mean, growing up, there was a stark difference between Democrats and Republicans. But when it came to what was best for the country, more often than not, they would come together. And it seems like today there's none of that. And it seems like it's getting worse rather than better with the partisan politics that's going on. And I think it's pulling our country apart.
It is pulling our country apart, right? We forgot that we will pay any price. We will meet any burden. We will defeat any enemy in order to preserve freedom. That is a paraphrase of John F. Kennedy, but it's absolutely true. And we forgot about the fact that we have to come together for economic prosperity, fiscal responsibility, and the safety and security of Americans. You know, one of the things that I'm doing right now, just to let you know, is I just went through the entire hiring process to be a police officer at Hampton Police Department. I'm in the police academy right now.
Oh, no kidding.
I'm giving back to my community. You know, we can't find police officers. Basically, there's about 4,000 police officers in the state of New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And from last March to this July, over 200 have left. We can't recruit anybody. It's very hard to recruit. It's very hard to get the quality that we need. And so I figured, you know, I've been a police officer before in Laconia, New Hampshire in 1980. I went through class number 4, and now I'm going through class number 281, right? So, you know, they said, hey, we can't grandfather you because a lot's changed since 1980.
Don't we know that?
Yeah.
Growing up, I mean, I spent a lot of time in New Hampshire, then later on moved there. And the police officers there in New Hampshire were always, I thought, very professional. But, you know, with the world we're living in today, so many police officers are getting, you know, disoriented, but disillusioned, I guess would be the better word, with the way things are going, and they're not retaining people. Guys are retiring, and that needs to stop, because this whole defund the police thing, that needs to go away.
It's terrible, Steve. It's terrible what's going on. The demoralization of our police officers, the disrespect to their families, you know, what we're doing to their years and years of service, those that have fallen. You know, the suicide rates among police officers now are 50% higher than the deaths in, you know, in the line of duty. Right now, I would tell you that, you know, suicide is a line of duty death. Right. If they're taking their life because of the pressures, because they're not getting the help that they need, you know, that's a casualty. Right. That's a casualty of, you know, and it's a tragedy is what it is. The same thing in the military with our high rates of suicide in the military. Depression is, you know, you're like 54% more likely to be depressed as a police officer than you are in any other profession in our society. And that's pretty significant, right? And it's because we're making them feel bad, right? We're you know, telling them that they're bad people and that we don't appreciate what they do for us. And that's wrong. And it's mostly coming from political leaders, right? Which is even worse. The same political leaders who go around with bodyguards you know, armed bodyguards, and they want to take away your Second Amendment rights, and they want to defund the police. They make absolutely no sense to me.
No, and, you know, with you running against Maggie Hassan up there in New Hampshire, what are some of the issues up there that, you know, the people of New Hampshire are looking to you to to change the landscape, basically, of what's going on up there?
Well, first and foremost, election integrity is big, right, up here in New Hampshire. We want the federal government to stay out of our elections. So this HB1 and SB1 nonsense that you know, the representatives and the senators want to do, interfere with our election process and take it over from the states, is absolutely wrong, violation of the Constitution. So they want me to make sure that I go down there and make sure the federal government stays out of our business, right, when it comes to elections. They also want me to be a voice for them inside the state to get our state, to get our governor and get our legislature, you know, to fix the election integrity issues that we have here in New Hampshire. Our machines are broke here and nobody has any confidence in them. So in 2022 election coming up, we want a hand count. We want an audit of these machines. We want mandatory ID. We want a law that stipulates and says, hey, if you don't live here, you can't vote here. How about that one? And we want to repeal HB 1266, which is a House bill here that expanded mail-in voting, which created more corruption. And we want to bring that back to what it was before so that we don't have mail-in voting corruption. And then, you know, we have a huge problem with out-of-state college students voting in this state. We got to make sure we do that by getting rid of same-day voter registration. Same-day voter registration is an election integrity nightmare. All these things we don't allow other countries to do when we're helping them with their elections, but we're okay with it here in America. That's just wrong, right? It's none of that is voter suppression. It's all ensuring that that your vote counts, that you know your vote counts, that someone's not stealing your vote or not counting your vote appropriately. And that's what they want me to do with election integrity. They want to fix health care. The number one reason for personal bankruptcy here is health care. And we got to fix it. It's broke. They want me to help with veteran issues. We got to get the VA fixed. You know, the bureaucracy there in Washington, D.C. from the VA needs to be fixed. All these bills that they're putting in are all Band-Aid solutions. The big problem is the bureaucracy, and we got to fix that bureaucracy. And if we do that, then we'll go a long way in ensuring that our veterans have the care that they need, their families have the care that they need, and we'll be, you know, we'll be good to go. One of the things that I completely disagree with right now is the VA requiring all their doctors to have the COVID shot. I mean, that's a violation of their constitutional rights. I mean, that's wrong, right? They're the first government agency to do that. Listen, I don't care if you get a shot. I don't care if you don't get a shot, right? That's your business. The government needs to stay out of your personal healthcare business. And this is wrong. I don't believe the VA should be paying for sex changes, right? And they just decided to do that too. I mean, that's wrong, right? I mean, how do you service connect somebody wanting to get a sex change? You can't service connect it. It's political. And they're bringing politics in everything that we do. Border security hurts New Hampshire. 95% of the fentanyl that leads, you know, we have a huge opioid crisis problem here. It's worse than it's ever been. And 95% of it comes from the southern border, right? Same thing with human trafficking, weapons that come in here. They want some help. You know, they want us to do something, you know, about that. Energy is another big thing, right? We need to be energy independent. We got to leverage all forms of energy. We got to create more jobs with that. They want people with national security experience to fight against China, to fight against Russia, to fight against Iran and North Korea, and keep them the hell out of our business, right? Right now, we have people that don't have any national security experience, and they're Chinese sympathizers and Russian sympathizers. And when you do that, you help out Iran and you help out North Korea. And border and immigration, terrible, terrible, terrible. We have huge problems. And then the last one is infrastructure and critical infrastructure, and the broadband issue gaps that we have here. Certainly, as a senator, I can help with that, and I will help with that.
Excellent. So I know you're pressed for time. We can't talk too much longer, but tell our listeners where they can find your message on there and how they can support your candidacy.
Sure. So I need support, right? I'm not an independently wealthy man. I'm not a career politician, so I don't have a political machine behind me. And I'm a political outsider, so I don't have the establishment behind me. And I think people want to get rid of the establishment. They don't trust career politicians. I am for term limits. One of the first things I'm going to do is sign on as a co-sponsor to Ted Cruz's term limits bill, right? So as a political outsider, as someone who understands public service, as someone who understands leadership, someone who understands who they are and what my strengths and weaknesses are and my strong national security experience, please go to www.donbaldick.com. Read about me. But I need help, and any amount donation will help. You know, pass the word, send it out to people, particularly if you're here in New Hampshire or if you know people in New Hampshire. You can count on me going down there to serve you. That's all I know how to do. That's all I want to do. And that's why people want me to run.
Well, sir, we want to thank you for your time. Thank you for your service. And thanks for being forthcoming about especially those PTSD issues, because that is something that's a stigma that still is haunting our veterans community. I mean, the numbers of suicides are not going down. It seems like
no, they're not.
And, you know, and we need people like you to step forward to remove that stigma from the troops themselves, but also to make some of the changes so to help people out, you know, in the bureaucracy, as you said, with the VA. But before we go, if you want to get SoftRep on your phone, download our free mobile app to get easy access to articles, podcasts, gear reviews, all perfectly formatted to your device. Please subscribe to SoftRep.com to get access to all our library of ebooks and our exclusive team room forums and content available on all your Apple and Android devices. Sir, thank you for taking the time again with us today. We appreciate it. And all the best of luck to you. And, you know, one of these days we got to get back up to Laconia and visit some friends.
Well, you come back up here. I'd love to have coffee, lunch with you. Thank you so much. I love SoftRep. You guys do a lot of great work for our service members and their families. You tell it the way it is. You're looking for the truth. And I really, really appreciate that.
All right, sir. Thank you once again. And all the best.
God bless you, too. And best to your listeners. Thank you.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.